Thank you for the introduction. I didn't subscribe to a laugh track in the background, but I'll just speak a little louder, I guess. As a remote sensing scientist and physical scientist, these are really very exciting times technologically for the equipment. Many of the instruments have been invented years ago, but the capabilities have increased dramatically and the costs have gone down. And then recently, I was approached by Mike Gore and Jeff White to collaborate on this high-throughput phenotyping idea. I didn't know much about it because, of course, I do different things. And I find it extremely exciting, and the audience this afternoon obviously finds it exciting. So I think it's going to be very interesting 2 years ahead, especially as we use remote sensing techniques. I'd like to acknowledge my team, or I'm part of the team that made this possible. Pedro Andrade Sanchez is the one that knows how to make this project operational. Mike Gore are the brains behind the genetics and phenotyping. Mike Salvucci knows about the microbiology. Kelly Thorpe is also a remote sensing scientist and crop modeler. Doug Hunsaker is the one that kept the plants from drying out and monitoring the irrigation. And Jeff White, also a plant physiologist and coordinator. And lastly, I want to acknowledge Cotton Incorporated, who was pivotal and really critical for pulling this experiment off. So these are the five main objectives here that I'd like to present briefly this afternoon. Obviously, we want to increase crop yields while facing global climate change and water availability will be stressed. We want to do that through genetic improvement via modern plant breeding, and we think that that's the most sustainable and economic approach. And we do that by developing superior heat and drought tolerance varieties, but that and by conventional means is slow and very difficult. And that's the G by E and complex traits are the attributes that make that slow and difficult. So, of course, we think, as many of you in the audience do, is that the progress could be improved by developing new ways to relate plant phenotypes with desirable plant genotypes. And thus, my role is in developing field-based remote sensing, or I should say proximal sensing, because a lot of the work that I do is from 700 kilometers above the Earth, and this is just a few meters above the plant. So we'll call it proximal sensing in deference to the distance. We're going to look at spectral radiation properties that can detect chlorophyll content, leaf area index, cover, photosynthetic radiation, photosynthetic efficiency, canopy water stress. Those are some of the attributes we can detect. Radiometers and imagers are readily available, high quality. Some are very low cost, off the shelf. And lastly, the data acquisition rates for these can be very high, and the computational facilities are readily available, so we should use them. I might also add that I have sort of developed a philosophy, and when I do evapotranspiration modeling, many people come out with these models and say, well, we need to make these simple and robust. Well, I go take the contrary viewpoint. I say, we have the computational facilities, we have the way to deal with complexity, let's roll the complexity and deal with it with our modern equipment. So what are the components of a field high-throughput phenotyping system? Well, I list five here. There are instruments to measure the traits, platform and vehicles to support, control, and power the instruments, log the outputs, transport the platform over field plots, data management and analysis to convert the raw data to information-rich formats, system management to ensure the reliable, efficient execution of all aspects of the process, and reproducibility. And that last aspect is really crucial here. We don't have at the USDA the resources that corporations do, and we want to be able to see the ideas we do developed elsewhere, and particularly we want to make sure the software is available for everyone. Well, the usual debate amongst remote sensing scientists is, do you want to take images or do you want to take radiometric measurements? Well, there are pluses and minuses of each, and to cut to the chase, I'll say you use both. Here are some illustrations of numerous radiometric instruments ranging from very old instruments to modern day. I'll go across the top row here, if I can find the cursor. Here we go. This is an active remote sensing device manufactured by CropCircle. They have a display here at the convention, and it actually generates the light and receives the light to generate vegetation indices, or in fact, any visible or near-infrared radiation you'd like to measure. Over here in the middle are thermal infrared radiometers that can be accurate to better than a tenth of a degree Celsius. At the lab I work with, we calibrate all those internally to a very high degree, although the manufacturers usually don't specify better than 0.3 degrees, but we do this in our own constant temperature room. And these thermometers, by the way, are capable of much more accurate temperatures than you can achieve with imagers. On the upper right hand is an instrument for measuring plant fluorescence. Again, the manufacturer is available here. This has potential for high throughput phenotyping because, of course, we could get photosynthetic efficiency through measurements, potentially through measurements such as these. Now, on the lower row, and this I show for maybe partial amusement, but actually it's practicality. This is an Exotech radiometer. It was manufactured in the 1970s to measure radiation to validate satellite data. We still use this instrument. It's very accurate. And it's a way to measure narrowband response in the field. And then there's a reference panel there that we use to calibrate all our data. But in the 2000s, this is what our option is. This is a photodiode that you can purchase for approximately 50 cents. This is extraordinary. So now we can hook up tens, hundreds of these things if we're equipped computationally and communication-wise to handle it. Such diodes can give you the radiometric resolution you need over the plant. To the right of that is just an illustration of some interference filters that you can readily purchase for under $100 that can select the bands. Once you've identified the bands in the visible or infrared bands that you wish to look at, you can purchase these. Most of these are standard filters. And lastly, on the right is acoustic transducers, which can be used to measure plant height. And I have never worked with these until this summer, and I have to say that they're quite impressive accuracy, and they can work well on the phenotyping platform. Well, here are some of the imaging instruments that we use by contrast. Obviously, imaging has a benefit, is that you're not just lumping entire field of view into a measurement. You know where your temperatures or your reflectances are coming from. This is an illustration of a thermal camera that we have recently purchased that can require images at 25 hertz. Now, why in the world would we want to acquire images at such a high frame rate? Well, it's because there's temperature variations at very high frequencies in addition to diurnal variations in temperature that could be interesting. It could tell you something about plant stress. On the right-hand side are some older instruments that we use, including another thermal infrared camera right here, a commercially available single-lens reflex called Sigma that you can remove the infrared blocking filter and select the bands you want. And over here is a multispectral camera formerly manufactured by Duncantech. So you have options is the point here. You can collect images at high frame rates as you traverse through a field to do through phenotyping. You can collect these data and transmit them through such options as USB, FireWire, Ethernet, very high data rates. Okay, so we have some images, we have some radiometers. How are we gonna move this thing through our field? Well, this illustrates, I think, some of the spectrum of platforms. Of course, there's the human platform. We're trying to get away from that. And then there's the airborne platform, which I use, but it's too costly. This is a helicopter platform, and it costs roughly $1,200 to do a field experiment. And we find that quite useful, but it would certainly not be practical on a routine basis. Satellites. I don't mean that tongue-in-cheek to show the satellite up there, because some satellite resolution is now 60 centimeters. These things are up there. Periodically going overhead, 8 to 16 days, something like that. It could be that there are enough satellites up there to image the field if your fields are large enough. On the right-hand side over here, a cable robot is sort of our dream platform. I can't say that we'll be able to build it this summer, but Jeff White has been in contact with Bosselman, who's at NIST in Gaithersburg, Maryland. He's actually built such devices. You've probably seen them at football games where they traverse the field. So this is, in essence, a flying carpet. You can mount a remote sensing platform here, and you can traverse anywhere in the field rapidly and efficiently. Now, the advantage of doing this is that you're not just sampling the field maybe one time a day or one time a week. You can do this hourly. You can look at dynamic properties and reflectances and surface temperatures throughout the day in a semi-automated way. On more cost-effective techniques, or the lower row here, is a linear move, which we're looking at. We own a linear move, or actually Maricopa owns such a device. It takes an hour to move across the field. It's kind of lumbering, but it's very reliable, very practical from that point of view. It can be GPS controlled. In the middle is a gantry crane. This is just, I took this off the web. This has been used in Europe. I've seen some publications. That's a good way to do it, but not terribly fast and certainly not inexpensive. And lastly is a high clearance tractor, which I will show you in a moment of how this is deployed. This was a way to quickly get out in the field and test the instruments, so to overcome the obstacle of a platform to do phenotyping. Here are the components of that platform. We have shrouds here in the lower right that are custom built so that we could go to the cotton field. This is the cotton experiment, but we're not constrained to just cotton. And on that we have a toolbar where we mount these active remote sensing, labeled crop circle here, 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 and here, and not illustrated below will be thermal infrared thermometers hanging down here. So this is about 2 meters above the canopy at this time. And in the middle here is GPS, RTK unit, which is certainly accurate to better than half a meter. And down here is an acoustic transducer. We have just one of them, measures plant height. So all this gets logged on the tractor. The tractor can traverse the field within an hour. So on the next component of an HTP system is data management. I won't linger on that, but I just wanted to point out some of the aspects that occurred to us as obstacles and as issues that we have to deal with. We need to log the data. We need something robust that can withstand high temperatures in Arizona where we work. It's frequently 110 degrees or hotter in the summer. So we have solid-state loggers, memory cards, laptop computers, and hard drives that have to be robust. And this possibility of the data rates are slow of moving that over wireless techniques. And then we have to deal with post-field data processing. If we don't need live data, we can transport that data back in the lab and incorporate it in a geographic information system, GIS, use conventional spreadsheets, statistical analyses. And the data volume for last summer was 35 gigabytes, which is actually very modest, but that we didn't use a lot of images. So what we envision, or at least I envision, is that this is going to be over terabytes of images once we start incorporating something like a FLIR infrared camera. But here's the field setup from last summer. It's in Maricopa, Arizona, which is about 30 miles south of Phoenix. Hot, dry, it doesn't rain a lot there. It's a very good place for demonstrating a high throughput phenotyping system. Obviously not exclusively there if you want a test environment, but a great place if you're looking for lots of sunny days. This is the field, approximately 100 meters by 100 meters. We had a local meteorological station we have here. We have reflectance tarps, which we calibrate all our remote sensing, our proximal sensing data with. And these are the field trials here. And the ones that I'd like to highlight are the bottom two rows here. This is a water-limited regime treatment here. And this is a well water. And the colors are indicative of infrared thermometers. So this is not an image. This is generated in aggregate from radiometers. And I think it doesn't need much persuasion to show that the well-watered with the bluer colors is substantially cooler than the water limited here. And also, you could distinguish between soil temperatures and plant temperatures. So the experiment had 25 Pima varieties that are well characterized in terms of drought and heat tolerance. We used two treatments, 100% and 50% of evapotranspiration based on a crop coefficient and Penman-Monteith approach, and we had 4 reps. So here's some more aspects of the system. It's drip irrigated. The soil moisture was monitored with soil neutron probes. We had on-site meteorological station, which gave us 10-minute averages of air temperature, humidity, wind speed, wind direction. We did these tractor surveys at different intervals, at least weekly, sometimes daily, and on occasion hourly. We ran through the field in the morning, early morning, mid-morning, late morning, particularly because the temperatures are highly dynamic. So that's the kind of thing you'd want to use on something like a cable robot system. We looked at the following attributes. We looked at NDVI, conventional vegetation index, this PRI, which is a photosynthetic reflectance index, which is supposed to be indicative or a proxy for photosynthetic efficiency, using a green band, surface temperature, plant height with the acoustic. We have four of the crop circles here. We have IRTs in four positions, replicated twice. And again, plant height is repetitious here. We did some special surveys where we use imaging with a thermal camera, the FLIR camera. We did hyperspectral imaging, hyperspectral radiometry, which going all the way out to 2.5 micrometers from blue all the way into the shortwave infrared. We did a fluorescence test. We did spot checking with photosynthesis with the LIGOR instrument and ancillary agronomic observations. So the NDVI series was conducted this way, mainly to get canopy density as a reference. This is not exotic proximal sensing by any means. The arrows indicate the direction, a particular pass of how that was sampled. And the background is an image and GIS-based observations of NDVI. On the right-hand side shows you the well-watered and the water-stressed vegetation deck, showing you a clear differentiation according to day of year. Well, I put this slide in because this is sort of my background of a thermal infrared remote sensing scientist, just to show you that not only do visible near-infrared wavelengths have spectral information, but the thermal infrared bands also can tell you something about plants and soil characteristics. The green, red, and mainly the green and red curves here are spectra from different backgrounds of sandy, bare soil, and grass and sandy soil information here. And you can see in the shorter wavelengths, 8 to 10 micrometers, there's quite a differentiation in spectral radiance. The smooth curves are Planck black body and gray body reference curves. Just to show you that this is a new avenue, new spectral information that could be exploited in such a system. Well, so what do the temperatures look like over cotton here? I'll show this enlargement of this graph here in the next slide. And this shows you the well-watered and water-limited regimes for the 24 Pima varieties at two different times of day. And on the lower left, you can see that the temperature variation, of course, of the day. The black is air temperature, and the blue is the well-watered Pima canopy, and the red is the water-limited. You can see here around noon that the water-limited crosses over air temperature. So to say that, to infer that canopy temperature is warmer or cooler than air, is it depends on the time of day. On the right-hand side, I wanted to show you, if I can find the cursor, here a little movie that we took of canopy leaves that had been drooping due to heat stress. It was strictly, I loaded this beforehand. Well, dang. Every time I do a PowerPoint, it fails on me. All right, well, this is the point of this illustration. These are canopy leaves. These are wooden dowels. And what we did is we forced the poor leaf to be more exposed to leaf, and then we dropped it down and raised it up. And what you can see is the thermal inertia of the cotton plant is very short time. This plant will heat up 5-10 degrees within a half a second. So it just illustrates that you have to measure temperatures frequently. You might have to get a statistical sample to that, or if you have a camera such as this FLIR one, you could measure at 25 hertz and get that dynamic. So here's the illustration of the canopy temperature measured with the IRTs on the tractor. If you look at the blue and the red, for example, those are the well-watered regimes, and you follow each of these varieties, you can see how the temperature climbs about 5 Celsius. And then if you look at the 10 and 1 p.m. water limit, you can see that the temperature variation is 7 degrees or greater. The purple shows you the extreme temperatures that it climbed up to at 1 p.m. Here is at 43 Celsius, so quite warm. Montserrat, for example, is a variety that it isn't well adapted, gets quite hot. Here's one I don't know much about, P62, quite hot. Well, as a person working with instruments, I never trust them without checking them all the time. They're always going to go out of calibration. And when we use different instruments, you have to compare them. So we did what we called a Golden Day spectrometer study, where we did the old human approach, human transport approach. We went out in the field and carried the different instruments with us in tandem across these cotton varieties to check their accuracy. And this illustrates what we get out of those studies. We show, for example, in the near-infrared, that the plants under the wet regime and the dry regime are readily distinguishable in the near-infrared. Here you can see at 800 to 900 nanometers that there's about a 10% difference in reflectance here. These are water absorption bands down here, very strong water absorption bands at longer wavelengths versus this, the green bump here at 550 nanometers. So the visible near-infrared wavelengths are the ones that most people are familiar with because that's what silicon chips can use. And use the longer wavelengths, we can get more information about water absorption bands, but we need to use different technology. And this graph is intended to illustrate that, plus illustrate the variability of background light, which I know is a problem either outdoors or indoors. This is the gray. The gray is solar radiation about 30 kilometers above the atmosphere, and this is at the surface. You can see tremendous variations in water absorption bands. Some of these have CO2 absorption bands, but they can give you information about plant water content, plant water thickness. So I just show you, and then this is where you get your NDVI from these bands here. It shows you that there's a tremendous range of wavelengths that we're not typically using that could be incorporated in such a system. Well, this comes back to the old empirical approach of finding optimal bands for detecting particular attributes of plants. Jeff White did this graph and showing using an F probability graph versus wavelength with these spectrometer studies that we did on a golden day to illustrate different characteristics that you might look at for finding optimal bands. On the red circle here, so what we've done is we've compared the spectral curves versus including NDVI as a covariate and not including an NDVI here. Well, in this case, we found that the particular reflectance was correlated with NDVI, in other words, biomass, so it might not be a good spectral interval to use. In this case, circled around in green, shows you that the NDVI and that spectral interval, which is near the red edge, they're orthogonal to each other. So that could be, we already know that they are information rich, so good bands to work with. And these areas here, circled in blue, show they're confounded by canopy biomass, but they're longer wavelengths that most people don't look at, 1200 out to 2400 nanometers. So these are opportunities to look at in a high throughput phenotyping system. Lastly, I wanted to mention speculatively two ways we can measure photosynthetic efficiency. On the top is a fluorescence device that I mentioned before. We've been doing some comparisons with the Licor 6400 to validate the data that you can get from this. That might be a field deployable, at least on a tractor. You could put this onto your movable platform and measure every plant one by one, log them. And the second idea is to use this physiological, what's alternately called a photochemical reflectiveness index that I mentioned earlier. This is in a paper, John Gammon. It's frequently cited in the remote sensing literature for rangeland, but it possibly has application for cropland where we could look at photosynthetic efficiency at close range. It's based on 531 nanometers, the green bands here, and it's related to the xanthophyll pigments. So the effect is very small, which means that we have to be very careful about calibration, but a very interesting technique if we can get it to work consistently. So I'd like to leave it at the following points with you today. Is that proximal sensing discriminates the Pima cotton phenotypes we did last summer based on temperature, height, and density very nicely. The tractor-based platform is operational. We can do weekly surveys. It's robust. Plenty of power to run the platform. It's limited by canopy closure and payload. In other words, it's not our magic carpet yet, but we were able to get it running last summer very nicely. Hyperspectral studies suggest that additional spectral intervals for water stress detection are available. Visible near-infrared thermal-infrared imaging is certainly feasible and could help further discriminate between background shadows, soil, and the plant itself. We plan to repeat this experiment next summer. We will do wheat and camelin experiments. This is a biofuel crop. We'll do that this winter using some of these techniques. And we'll certainly, in the meantime, look at platform alternatives so that we can do this more quickly. Thanks very much.
Questions? Okay. monitor the energy. We try to do the energy balance so that we would know what the actual ET from the plant canopy would be. And that's based on your air temperature, radiometric temperature difference. Are we thinking of something else?
Oh, just whether that does, what that does is help standardize something for you, right? Rather than just looking at temperature, which obviously vary across the data.
That's correct. Well, the point of measuring high frequency temperatures is that there are temperature responses that can be in very high frequencies. When the wind blows through the field, it stresses the plant at a small degree. That temperature drop is going to depend on what leaf water thickness. And then we can measure it over the course of the day because, as Glenn knows, I've been involved in field experiments with thermal-infrared thermometry. We often measure those temperatures at 1,300 hours where maximum plant stress occurs. So you can do that. But I would not advocate measuring temperature just at one time of day.
Other questions? Yep.
If I were supposed to just do one time a day, would you recommend a time of day?
Well, then I would have to use 1,300 hours. Well, we're looking for the maximum plant stress, plant water stress. So if you did it at 9 o'clock, you would not learn very much. Because the land surface, the canopy and the soil are practically isothermal at sunrise. So you could take temperatures there as a reference and not have less to worry about calibration. So there's a reason to collect those early morning temperature days. But if you're really looking for the differentiation between phenotypes, then you'd want to do that in the afternoon.
Go ahead.
Can you comment on the critical stages of growth where you might have a response at temperatures?
Well, early in the season is very difficult to get good temperatures. I mean, in terms of plant stress, well, in this experiment, we didn't measure temperature stress per se. They were treatments. There were spot samples of water stress. We haven't produced those data yet.
Questions? Yeah.
So the nice thing about the infrared images is that you can see where the soil is, where the plant is. You can exclude the soil if you're trying to compare plant temperature genotypes. And I was just wondering, with the radiometer, how do you know that you're avoiding getting the soil temperature? Do you just have to have it really close to the leaf?
Yeah, although I prefer to get the canopy and not just the leaf. So you can angle it instead of looking straight down. The other strategy, because these thermometers aren't expensive, is to have two of them so that you can have one nadir view and one oblique. And that can allow you to partition the temperature and know whether you're getting contamination of your temperatures based on soil. And the other thing, of course, is the soil emissivities are a factor too. So you can filter based on looking at thermal bands in the 8 to 10 micrometer versus the 10 to the 12 micrometer bands. Because that shorter wavelength is where soils have large thermal variability that plants won't have.
Other questions?
Just,
more.
Just curious, you show us a spectrum of a vegetation count, and you show that there's a 10% decrease in terms of the water content, or you change water content. Do you have data to, or do you notice on data that actually the canopy structure basically play a big role there too?
You're right, the canopy structure does. In fact, one thing that I would like to learn more about from people is are tools that can, there's a device called flash LIDAR that can measure canopy geometry. That's sort of the, as one colleague says, that's sort of the holy grail right now of remote sensing, is to measure canopy geometry. And such a device would resolve that question, because obviously there's leaf angle change that will affect your reflectance.